I think there's a lot of tech people who aren't invested in security either. But for something you use every single day and you put all your information in it because we are tech literate, you got to protect that stuff.
Hello, friends. Welcome to another episode. Today I have joining me a security researcher, all-around iOS hacker, and generally tech nerd, Zachary Bennett, aka Alpine. Completely different way, and if anybody texts me, it will probably be in the audio, but hey ho, such is life with Apple things.
Hey ho. I'm one of those people who turns off all those sounds for that exact reason. I'll be like presenting something, I'll go ding ding ding. I'm like, okay. So we know, yeah, what I have to attend to after this meeting.
I didn't even realize before we get too far off the rails before we start. Do a proper introduction like a proper podcast. I didn't even realize, I wasn't even really thinking about it until I read a post the other day, you know, like everything comes up, like what I wish for iOS 16. And most of it's based on like things that have been in Android for ages. Just had this flashback of on Android actually being able to control the volume of different things. You know, like I can have the ringtone at this level, but the notification thing at this level, and the when I scroll past a video, it will be this level. And I was like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But no, iOS is just...
See, I'm nodding in a podcast, but I actually end up, much to my wife's dismay, I end up buying Android phones once in a while to play with them, especially like new Android versions.
Yep.
And that's one thing that I always love. Between that and like notification actions, you can like tell it to snooze by default. You don't have to do the Slack thing where you go into the actual settings of the application and set for wait 30 minutes.
Yep.
But you can also say, oh, I want this to go to my headphones. I want this to go to the speaker of the phone. I want this. I don't want to hear the sound at all. And you can change that right from the volume slider.
Yeah, just like simple things. It's almost as if people at Apple just don't have stuff like that and just...
Or they don't want to make it advanced.
Probably. But I guess I probably should introduce you now, you know, like a proper podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, Zach. You are one of the people that reached out to me when I was like, look, I need people to record with. And instantly, when I tapped on your profile, I was like, this dude was in jailbreaking. That's it. I'm in. I'm interested.
Yeah, that was a big part of my coming to technology, jailbreaking.
Yes.
It started super early.
Yeah, I was trying to think back when we were sharing notes the other day. I was trying to think back, you know, like when was I kind of into it? And I remember having a 3G, I think it was. And I think a friend of mine got the 3GS, which at the time, I think, you know, was locked to a network, I think, as all Apple devices were then. I think it was O2 over here. I think it was AT&T in the States, wasn't it, that they were all on. And I think he kind of bought it cheaply, and then we found a way to kind of, you know, to like unlock it without messing around with everything. And then, you know, I went through a rough guide on the internet, finding out how to jailbreak it and install like a specific tweak. And then upon that, just had my eyes opened to kind of everything else you could do with an iPhone unofficially, and, you know, like fell into this deep rabbit hole from then onwards.
I think jailbreaking was the way to actually do things correctly before Apple finally decided that that's how things should be.
Yes.
Unlocking a device from the network was a big part of this. Also applications like Tether Me, which I don't actually remember. I think it was Ryan Petrich. One of the bigger names in jailbreaking made it so that you could properly tether on your phone instead of the 128 kilobits a second that Apple was allowing at the time. But it really got people into understanding what can be done with this hardware.
Yeah.
Way before Apple decided that that's the route that they wanted to go. And I didn't start out like that. In the notes we were sharing, I kind of went down a rabbit hole. I liked the theming aspect of it. Yeah. Snowboard was my best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a household name for all the older people. You just wanted to change your icons just a tiny bit. And Snowboard really lets you do that, even if it was just turning them transparent or whatever. But I mean, yeah, I definitely think it opened Apple's eyes, and Apple has taken a lot of ideas, I'd like to say. I don't want to say Sherlocked or stolen, but
yeah, going right the way back to like the original iPhone. It was like a jailbreak that allowed you to install like applications on the device before Apple were even like, because I remember way back they only at the time was like progressive web apps that were the only thing that you could like install on your home screen.
Steve Jobs famously said, you don't need apps on the iPhone. people like Twitterific, like in the Icon Factory. That's where they got their start, is by making apps that were on Cydia, which is the app store, the better app store, I like to say.
That was like the original, wasn't iPhones. It? Yeah.
Yep.
Others now have obviously a bunch of different popped ones up. And yeah, I don't even know where to go from there. But yeah, Cydia was like, I think, well, I don't, obviously there's applications and just ridiculous amounts of tweaks that, exactly like you were saying, were, it was eye-opening from like a nerd's point of view, where you were just like, the iPhone can do all this stuff and it's Apple that are not doing it. They're not allowing it.
Yeah. A lot of people, that's why a lot of people still jailbreak. I mean, it's a lot harder than it is now. I kind of delved into it a little bit in the notes, but it's kind of a dead breed now.
Mm-hmm.
I still have a couple friends of mine who are extremely technologically savvy and refuse to go to Android for some reason or another. But they just want that extra functionality, so they'll leave a phone on a really low iOS version, which I don't completely condone, being with my background.
Yes.
But just for feature sets, things that iOS proper doesn't support or allow, that they can do with a third party. That's the whole reason for it. That's the reason why Jay Freeman, a.k.a. Sorek, made this to begin with. And
yeah,
I think his legacy definitely lives on, not that he's gone or anything, but just an important part of what the Apple devices that we use now do and the feature set that they have now.
Yeah, so. What do they call it? Control Center, that was like a tweak way back in the day, swiping up from the bottom, being able to just quickly control Bluetooth and all those sorts of things. I mean, you could really, I mean, the amount of times I completely fucked up my phone was just ridiculous, but you could really go deep in the weeds. But, you know, I tried to stay fairly, you know, sort of under the surface and still make my phone kind of resemble an iPhone, but, you know, allow things that just really should have been there from the start. And undoubtedly, there was clearly an influence that you can kind of see through Apple from those kind of early days and taking things and kind of going, oh, that's not a bad idea, and implementing it in, as well as obviously stealing clearly from Android.
Yeah, I definitely see the benefits. I definitely messed up at the time. I didn't have an iPhone. I was pretty young. I'm in my early 20s, but I had an iPod with that you could just jump into Safari and slide the little bar across like the lock screen on iOS 3.
Yeah, Jailbreak Me was just
Jailbreak
insane.
Me, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And I messed up that device more often than I'd like to admit, and I think my parents were a little bit peeved that I had to keep using the family Mac to restore my phone, tell them to put music back on it, because at that time, parental controls weren't a thing. They'd type in their password every time I wanted something, and my Apple ID was just a renamed generic one, but it messed up a lot of people's devices, and I think that's what got a lot of people into tech at the same time.
Yes, unimaginably so. I would imagine that your kind of interest was peaked then and still kind of, you can still point to it to say, like, that was the point where I was really interested in tech, right?
Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with the bad things that come with jailbreaking, too. You were allowed to do a lot of things that were, let's say, illegal.
yeah.
You could kick people off networks.
Yep.
You could run a shell on a mobile device, which was dangerous.
Very, very dangerous.
As someone who doesn't really know what can happen. But I really truly think that it was a positive outlook years later, even 10 years later. People who I know personally who made a whole career out of low-level programming because of hacking iPhones back in the day.
Yeah, the hacking culture still runs deep in almost every kind of Silicon Valley-based tech firm, and obviously it's spread out just completely from there to kind of envelop the world, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's an important part, breaking things to...
Yeah, I mean,
make them bend
engineer
your will.
Every tells you a story of, you know, like taking apart video players or God knows what and putting them back together. And I guess that's the same for developers, isn't it? and security experts and analysts is you break stuff and then you learn how it goes back together again.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what other specifics there are, but I truly think to this day that I would love to jump back into the jailbreaking scene, but like at this point it's the originals aren't there anymore, and you know, work life balance takes over and it's like I'm married now, working on a house and stuff like that, and it's as much as you'd love to think that you have all the time to do that again, it's not completely feasible.
Yeah, I guess that, I mean, You were obviously into it with the theming and stuff like that. We're talking to like iOS 7, that sort of era, aren't we? Where that, and I remember, you know, like each version of iOS comes out, you're relying on following all the people on Twitter that are, you know, that eventually will find some kind of vulnerability and stuff. And I guess a lot of people didn't really appreciate at the time, and a lot of people started to step back because of this reason. I guess it's because people don't realize how much effort and kind of time it takes to discover these kind of things and then, you know, kind of engineer a way to use them.
Yeah, I don't want to go off on a tangent either, but you can make a lot of money off of hacking a device that people hold in their pockets 24 hours a day, seven days a week. People like Pegasus and the NSO group. I think they're the same now that I said that.
Yeah, Pegasus, I think, is like million, the exploit, isn't it? The NSO.
The exploit by the NSO group.
NSO group, yeah.
At this point, I'm so sick of hearing about them that like every time a news story pops up about them, I just lose my mind because, I mean, there's a lot of people who, if they find exploits, they won't give them to Apple so they can be patched. They'll sell them to the NSO group or companies like them for millions of dollars. And jailbreaking was built on the finding the weak spots in iPhones. But now it's just kind of a money game. So the fun, I guess, is a really terrible word for it, but of jailbreaking your iPhone is not a thing anymore. It's whether people are willing to get rid of bugs that could fetch them millions of dollars, whether they want to go through with that or not.
Because it was always like
a tangent.
It's really interesting. You know, you see these things, and obviously the NSO group have been prosecuted and stuff in the States now, haven't they? But you know, it's interesting to think about the amount of exploits that have been given away. You know, in the pursuit of jailbreaking, because it was always a cat and mouse game, because you know the next update always fixed the hole. And, you know, people waited, and obviously, clearly, some of your friends are still waiting on ridiculously old versions of iOS until there was a jailbreak that came out, because people just got used to the way their phones work, or they're on a network that's not supported by the iPhone. But this is probably the problem, why that there is these kind of things still exist, but they're now sold. You know, you can't yeah. fix the iPhone completely, but they're now just not given away for free because it's such a valuable skill to have.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I have a few friends who are on T-Mobile plans, which is probably the cheapest postpaid carrier that you can be on in the States, and they kind of throttle you a little bit. But if you have an old iPhone on iOS 10, you can use something like TetherMe and get past those speed bumps that they put in place, so that you're not using your unlimited data, quote unquote, to its fullest potential. But kind of like I mentioned in the notes, for some versions of iOS, there are jailbreaks that are just now coming out that support super old 32-bit devices. We heard Apple talk about the whole 32-bit device debacle of, we're not going to allow this anymore, but there are still devices, I don't know, like the iPad Air 1, iPad Air 2, iPhones 5, things like that, who are 32-bit. Mm-hmm. And at one point, there was no jailbreaks for these phones. And finally, people are kind of like, oh, this is something that hasn't been done yet, and I really want to jump in and try it. So still today, we're seeing versions being jailbroken that are, God, what are we on, 15? And they're still working on, like, version 9. So it never dies. It just, people find new ways to do it, and it's incredibly interesting, and it really makes me think that there's still a low level community that isn't just, oh, I want to theme my device. They just want to kind of put it to the full potential.
Yeah, I guess that it also, if finding exploits reaches a stage where then I guess they're not worth, you know, selling to the NSO group or another company, so it's, you can release those into the wild, I guess. I mean, I wonder how many devices are out there. You know, Apple tout all these, like, so many percentage of people have upgraded to whatever, but, you know, you walk into retailers now, you know, that sell used phones, there's still iPhone 5s for sale and all that sort of stuff, so there must be, you know, a certain kind of limit to people still running jailbreakable iOS version.
Yeah, especially the devices that are capped to iOS 14. I don't know, it's like the 6 and 5S and devices like that. I mean, there are some C-suite level executives that I work with who were using an iPhone 5S, not like an SE or anything like that, that was still running old versions of iOS, and you're sitting here like, oh, there's a lot of data on this device, and these people, like, they're on a version of iOS that has been pwned, which is our favorite thing to say.
Yes.
Pwned. That's been pwned for this long. And you just, a lot of people don't realize that. And I don't want them to realize that, because I think it brings a level of anxiety that people don't need. But these phones are still usable to this day. I mean, yeah, they're a little slow, but if they're an email machine, like, no one cares. I mean, people like you and I probably buy new phones every year, every other year, just because we're in that world. But there's some people who are still using 4, 5, 6-year-old devices.
Yeah, so, which work perfectly fine. You know, they get the battery replaced every couple of years and carry on. You know how many grandmas are out there? But it's crazy to think that, you know, like, executives and stuff are still using this device with, you know, highly important information on, that can just, and they're using something so insecure. But I mean, people don't really get it, do they? You know, I remember my mum just not updating her phone for, you know, like years, because she was just like, don't even need to. What's the point? And there's also this kind of thing out there that every new version makes your phone slower.
I've given up on arguing with family members about that whole debacle. I think it started after Apple was slowing down devices because of the battery.
Yes,
and now everyone's
got
just
even worse, hasn't it? Since then, yeah.
I don't know what it's like in other continents. I mean, I have friends over there, but we don't really usually talk about family. It's usually like shop all the time, which is just work and what you're working on now. But family members will come up to me like, "Oh, why do you update so quickly?" I'm like, "Cause when you know the low level things that are happening, you know that if you don't update your device, there's going to be some hurt, or your passwords are going to get stolen, or the dreaded your now Meta account could be compromised, and you know how much you love that." I hate saying it. It's such a strong word, but in technology, I feel like I use it constantly. It's just unless you wanted to get into it, we're not going to get into it, but people just attribute companies with doing the wrong things all the time. And so I hear the "don't upgrade your phone, it's going to get slower." But I still do the whole gather up all the devices and update them all at the same time when I get home from work.
Yeah, if it's update day, it's update day for me. You know, like you go through and just update. And obviously, clearly, end up on the beta train, you know, like really early in the thingy. But trying to convince people to update is a completely different thing to just get there. Because I guess, you know, features that you or I care about. I remember once talking to somebody, you know, like in a bar or whatever, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, I'm on the like the latest version." I don't know what it was then. It would have been like iOS 11. And they're like, "Oh, what does it do new?" And, you know, I'm genuinely excited about like all the new features, and then you're explaining them and they're just complete stony faced. And I'm like, I guess that like average people don't give a crap, do they? Just like,
no.
I'm like, "Oh, there's a slide over window here and you can have widgets and stuff in there." They're like, what
cool.
Do I need? What do I need that for? I'm like, yeah, you've got me there.
Why is the weather app using so much battery? Oh, it's because it's in slide over and it's just over there and you didn't know about it.
Yeah.
How does it always know my location? Oh, because it's right there. Yeah,
I have similar conversations with people, you know, when I talk about like companies and, you know, security, things like that. So I'm guessing yours is like just through the roof, isn't it? Have you just given up trying to have those conversations with people?
Grandparents, I have it the most with, I think, because they are the ones who are, I mean, unbeknownst to them, so much stuff has happened in their lifetime. My grandparents are obviously in their 70s. Well, I guess that's not obvious, but I try to put it into layman's terms and it doesn't always work.
No.
But I always tell them that they need to make sure that they write things down. Not this digital stuff, not the, "Oh, what notes app am I going to use now that I'm going to transfer all my stuff over to?" Like, write it down in a book that you remember and make your passwords as randomized as you feel comfortable. And I'll end up setting them up with two-factor and things like that. And they don't really know. They don't understand. They have no idea what's going on. They have no idea why they need to text me to get an extra code.
Hmm.
But I kind of, I hate to say it, but I kind of signed myself up for it.
Yep.
But me being in tech and me going to school for tech kind of makes me the default person for that. And I don't have the security conversation with them. Quite frankly, my wife doesn't care, which is a terrible way to say it, but she's in healthcare, which is a whole nother factor. So she has so much to think about over there that if I came home and talked to her a bunch, excuse me, about security, I think she'd just roll her eyes and be like, you want to hear about HIPAA or something like that? It's hard to talk about with normal people. Being interested in it is great too, because I think there's a lot of tech people who aren't invested in security either. But for something you use every single day and you put all your information in it, because we are tech literate, you got to protect that stuff.
But yeah, it's crazy to think you saying like your wife doesn't care. I would say 90% of the world, you know, like doesn't really care, you know, and without going into, you know, talking about specific companies, I'm talking about, you know, like the amount of personal data you've got on your device is just absolutely staggering. You know, like how would you feel if that just disappeared or someone else had access to it? And it just, people just don't care, do they? You know, it's just one of those things where they're quite happy to, you know, update their Facebook status with God knows what, and, you know, give them all that information. And that's a hard enough conversation to have with people already, without going into, you know, like passwords, just, you know, like real simple security things. And I hate to think, you know, like the anxiety that must go with, you know, like working in real cybersecurity.
There's a lot of anxiety, especially now I'm going to talk world events, but we have an office in Romania, which,
okay,
as a lot of people know, is very close to the conflict.
Yeah.
I am, of course, pro-Ukraine. Ukraine giving hell to Russia,
yep,
showing them that they're the big guy. But they're really close, and they're accepting refugees from Russia. And, I mean, from Ukraine. Oh, mm-hmm. Gosh. And there, I got a call early one morning, like, oh, Romania's network is being attacked by pro-Russia activists. Mm-hmm. And that is the worst call to get in the morning, because you're going, you and a few other security people, mostly from managed service providers, so like the people who do the underlying systems, because one person can only do so much. But that's the worst thing you hear, because you don't know anymore. No one actually knows what capabilities these APTs or advanced persistent threats. So, yeah. Russia, China, North Korea. We can consider all those APTs. We don't know what kind of capabilities they have. They don't know if they could just destroy everything in the company. And it's just the thought of not knowing is probably the worst, because you can't give anyone an answer either. You can't tell people that their systems are going to be okay, because you don't know until you're like hands deep. You're like elbow deep in this stuff. A lot of people think it's like it's cool. You tell people that you do cybersecurity and it's super cool.
Yeah, but they imagine, you know, like a CSI type guy with code scrolling past and just, yeah, I can stop them from going into the server, you know, like with a few strokes of the keypad. And it's just not like
that. No, it's a lot of looking at text, scrolling text, and not in the way that you, like the terminal. You're looking at just logs constantly. And they don't tell you this when you start school. You think that you're going to go to school and you're going to get to do the ethical hacking. But I took law classes. I took all the law classes. I had to do ethics courses. I had to do technical writing. And you just think it's going to be fun.
Right.
But, I mean, you get to see something new every single day. And I hope people understand that keeping themselves secure is a positive thing, but I don't think a lot of people get it still, like we talked about earlier. I don't think they'll get it until it happens to them. So,
yeah,
as negative as it sounds.
Yeah, it is negative, and it's hard to kind of weigh up with, you know, like scaring the hell out of people to the point where they, you know, don't want to do anything. You know, there's a fine line, isn't there? I mean, I would consider myself into tech, you know, which I have been for years and years and years now. But I mean, the eye opener to me was, you know, like you start listening to things like Darknet Diary, and you know, there's episodes on there. The one that always sticks in my brain is the one that I now presume was about Boston Dynamics, because they never named the company, but it was sold from like a Silicon Valley company to a Chinese company. So I presume that, but I can't say for sure. But anyway, they were talking to this guy who eventually found that, you know, the hackers, quote unquote hackers, had been in the network, you know, just observing things for years. You know, they'd obviously found a backdoor, left it open, and it's, a, I guess, with insecurity, a lot of it is just you only really find something until they start to do something, I would guess, start to remove data or change data and stuff. And it's only really then that you can then go back and kind of see how much has been, you know, or how long the hackers have been. I hate using the word hackers, but how long, you like, the threat's been in there.
It's such a catch-all word.
Yeah.
Oh, you're hacking everything. Like, there's offensive, there's defensive, there's blue teaming, red teaming. That's a whole different part of it. But I believe you're correct. I think it was Boston Dynamics. Jack does amazing work putting it into terms that everyone can understand. I'm in a group chat with a bunch of people, people that you've actually, I think, maybe interviewed in the past, but every time there's a new episode out, we all just share, and they're all like, oh, this makes this, like, gives me anxiety. I'm like, I feel like that's the point.
Yeah, I think
that's why they tell these stories. But to your comment, you don't always know if someone's in your network. They could be using a really old user account. Sally from accounting left 15 years ago, but the IT person at the time never disabled it properly. Mm-hmm. So now Sally from accounting is someone from some other country, and they are in your network, and they have access to financial data. But no one talks about that. They just talk about the hacker. They don't really give you ways to fix problems like this. They just talk about hackers, and hackers get what they want. But there's so many punchlines that drive me insane, but like, humans are your worst asset, things like that. Like, everyone makes mistakes. I'm not saying that it's anyone's fault ever. But there's always going to be someone one step ahead of you. And I think Jack Sider, who does Darknet Diaries, does an excellent job about showing people what can happen and the importance of knowing your systems, and making people who aren't familiar with this industry, like, realize what happens on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, I mean, from the company that I work for, you know, some of it is just educating people that is Sally from accounting, you know, to just educate them that that email that they've got, you know, that looks legitimate from the guy in the follow over department might not necessarily be the case. You know, we've had cases where organizations have, you know, intercepted email chains, you know, like in the middle of email chain, where you get into the stage of confirming bank details and stuff. They're not the bank details. You know, someone has set up a URL that is, you know, two letters the way round, and, you know, managed to do that for some, you know, bizarre reason. And it's getting to the stage where it's just a constant conversation with people, isn't it? And Jack does an awesome job of, you know, breaking stuff down, because most of the stuff, if it wasn't kind of digested by him and put into words, I wouldn't understand. So certainly, like, you know, like the normal person would just not get it.
Yeah, there's a lot of podcasts with a lot of hosts that do the lower level stuff that professionals would understand, but having people like Jack explain it that way. It's excellent. And on the whole email thing, email is the bane of every IT person's existence.
I'd imagine, yeah. Talk to me. Preach, brother.
it's inherent. It was never meant to do what it's doing now. I think everyone will tell you that. And that's really all I want to say on that, because it's such a sore topic.
Yes.
But, God, if someone could figure out the email problem, they'd be a millionaire, but no one will, because
email by design is, you know, like not secure, isn't it? You know, to be interoperable with everything else. You know, we're talking about the EU messaging being interoperable, and to do that, you have to break, you know, the security of stuff, don't you?
Yeah. You being in the EU is very different as well. I'm in the States, obviously, because I don't have a sweet accent like you guys do.
I don't know about that.
everyone says it. It's one of those things when people come from Europe, especially, everyone's like, oh, must be from like London or something. They just automatically go to London, but that's not the point. Just people trying to make email more secure are doing great work, but set up technological advances, things like that, like it's always just going to be the same.
Yeah, I don't think it. And there's, unfortunately, there isn't anything that's going to come after email. You know, like us guys, we probably, you know, like we've adopted Slack and or Teams or whatever it is. But, you know, Sally from accounting is always going to send you an email. I feel like Sally from accounting is getting a lot of stick this episode. But, you know, it's interoperable with absolutely everybody that works in it.
Yeah,
and the bigger the business, the worse, I think.
Sorry to Sally from accounting, but it could be Bob from engineering even.
Yes.
Just because you're tech literate doesn't mean that you are making the best decisions all the time, which is fine, because I don't think anyone was really made to hold all this information in their heads. But at the same time, we want things to be more secure, but there are governments that are trying to make things less secure so that they can have their little hands into it. Europe's the worst purveyor of this kind of thing.
Yes, I think
so. Get rid of encryption.
And unfortunately,
it's going to turn into shilling on my end, I guess.
Yeah, unfortunately, the states usually follow, you know, like EU kind of crap in that demand. You know, with GDPR, which was, I guess, a good move for, you know, personal privacy, but. Yeah, the government's thing is like a huge, huge thing. You know, the UK government have launched this kind of backdoor, kind of undermining encryption thing already. They're spending like millions of pounds, you know, won't you think of the kids, you know, that sort of thing to kind of get rid of encryption, because, you know, it sort of dissolves it down to an unwinnable argument, wasn't it, when they're just talking about, well, if we get rid of encryption, it'll stop child porn. And you're like, you know, there's no response to it. It's just, you're dealing with people that don't really know what they're talking about. So the general public is just going to side with protecting the kid.
Yeah. Protecting the kids is the best argument that they can give you for undermining your privacy and security.
Yeah.
I feel for you guys, especially because, I mean, God, even sharing medical records, you feel, is something that should always be protected. But everyone's assuming, too, that the government doesn't have any moles. They don't have any holes. They don't have any problems. But if you want to stalk your ex, from
which wherever. Absolutely happened. Snowden reported several times that, you know, the GCHQ and the NSA were, you know, employees were using it to see what their like exes were up to and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest problem with these things. I mean, I'm a big proponent of Signal. I got everyone who uses normal SMS over to Signal in my family circle. and they just want to undermine that. And like, I don't think the government like needs to know everything that me and my wife are talking about or me and my dad are talking about. I think in the states that the Constitution protects that a little bit, but the whole kids argument is overused to the point that you can't even argue it because then you seem like a you know what. And
yeah, exactly.
I'd say an apologist is a good word without using anything else. Like, I understand the need for moderation. You have all these social media sites popping up that say no moderation so that we can be as wrong or apolitical as we want. But there has to be some.
Yes.
Because if it's not real people, it's bots. And if it's not bots, it's people who wish to undermine everything that people have worked towards. So I look forward to seeing what happens with it. I know that there are some like nonprofits that are fighting for the right to have encryption. ACLU and the EFF come to mind. I'm a big proponent of donating to them, not only because it's tax deductible, which is great, but because they actually do. Listen to me talk about taxes. But they care about these issues. They don't want to hear the excuse for the children over and over and over again.
It's the argument with everything, isn't it? It was the argument with, you know, being able to intercept stuff with, you know, with the Snowden leaks. It's now the argument against encryption. It was the argument against like Tor and the dark web. It was, I think, way back in the day, they started to use it against like encrypted chat apps. You know that, you know, it was the arguments against WikiLeaks. It's just a tired argument for, you know, we haven't been fighting for this kind of stuff, you know, and openness and stuff for, you know, like 5 minutes. It's been since the, or it seems like even as soon as the web began, people were trying to encrypt the communication across the web because they realized how important it was. And we weren't dealing with nerds. We were dealing with, you know, mathematicians that came up with like PGP and stuff like that, because they were already sold the idea. And the web has just mutated into this thing where we can't avoid it. You know, it's detrimental to everyday life. You know, try living without the internet. And like you were saying, everything should be personal, shouldn't it? But and it, I try arguing with people that are just like, well, I don't care if Facebook know if I go to the gym and this and that and the other. It doesn't bother me. And, you know, like, well, should we just get rid of free speech then? Because you've got nothing to say?
That's a great way to put it, too, especially for people who I really think it comes from. I don't want to say tech illiterate because I don't think that's the case, but a lot of people seeing these services, especially Facebook, I'm guilty of being on Twitter because that's where a lot of the community is. But a lot of people see that there's a benefit towards having them know everything, whether it's ads that are tailored to you or they can find people that you didn't know were on the platform. That's all fine, but like I got off of Facebook proper, so like everything that they own, because of the creepiness, because it didn't feel right to me. My wife's on Facebook because I still have family members who swear by it.
Yeah.
And that's just a little window into being able to be a part of family events, I guess, which is fine inherently. But I mean, you watch one kitten video and you see that across the internet for months, which isn't terrible. It could be something worse, but they just undermine your physical I don't know if you had heard it in your circles or not. It was a big thing that happened when Apple did tracking transparency stuff. There were period tracking apps and things like that that were essentially tracking you via IP address. and it would see that you were getting really close to, I'm not pretending that I know everything about women either.
Yeah.
So I don't want the stereotype to come out, but Facebook would know that you were pregnant before you did.
Wow.
And I'm saying a general you, but this data was being exfiltrated from these period tracking apps to whatever advertiser could buy this from you. And when you see that firsthand, that's when it kind of clicks for you. But I think, like the security issue, you don't care until you get hacked. You don't care until you notice that it's a little bit creepy.
Yeah, it's just amazing what people will put up with. I've had the exact argument that you've had, you know, like, oh, if I get better ads, then more be it to it. And I'm like, yeah, but what happens if Facebook knows that, you know, your wife's pregnant? And also with it, obviously, every single data broker, advertiser, whatever, that also gets hold of your data. And then something, you know, God forbid, happens, and you then get baby adverts for the next 9 months, you know, for
it. Yeah.
And so do all your friends, and they're all advertised to. You know, there's a limit to everything.
General vicinity, they know.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? You know, you get this kind of tired thing that, like, oh, Facebook must be listening into my phone calls because me and so-and-so were talking about this, and then I didn't search for it, and then I got an advert. I'm like, no, they're not, because they don't need to, because they know everything about you and all of your friends. You know, I don't even have, there's 1,000,000% an account on Facebook for me, with all my data in, because of the amount of people that I know that do use Facebook, but I don't, you know, people just don't think about that.
There's a big talk in tech circles, like, oh, what's like the next step towards getting away from this creepiness? And I was like, there's not really one, because you got to get everyone on that platform. After Mr. Tesla, I won't even say his name.
You can't say, definitely don't say it three times, because it like summons the minions, I think.
I'll have a bunch of Tesla owners in my parking, in like parked right in front of my house.
I mean, they are awesome cars, but the guy's a douche.
I do agree. I do agree. They are an excellent piece of machinery. But when he proposed to buying the Blue Bird, everyone thought that they would move to Mastodon and make it better. But there's issues with that, too. Like, I think I spend too much time on Twitter. I think most people spend too much time on Twitter.
I definitely spend too much time on Twitter. Definitely.
Oh, wait, that's kind of how this happened. But there's no new way. There's no new thing that's going to come out and replace it.
No.
Like, if you think Mastodon's going to come in and replace this thing that 50% of the world population is on, you're wrong.
Yeah. That's it.
It comes back all in a circle to jailbreaking, too, because Twitter was so popular that people wanted a dedicated app. So these developers were like, oh, okay, we'll just put it on the Cydia store and you can get it from there.
Yeah.
And then you can have your own personal live blogging platform from your pocket on a dedicated app, because even in 2007, 2008, right before the App Store came out, people were doing that. So if they think that Twitter, God forbid Facebook, Instagram is going to fail and it's going to be replaced by unfederated open source option, then I think hindsight is 2020, and people won't see it until people get bored of this new shiny and move back to Twitter.
Yeah, the real problem is that services like that are, they cater too well for what we want. You know, like, if people leave Twitter, they want another Twitter somewhere else, and you just don't get that. You know, like, and the
Twitter
excuses.
3.0.
Yeah. I mean, what was that? Was it app.net or whatever that tried to be a Twitter clone? Do you know what? It was great. You know, it was a fantastic idea, you know, to pay for something and not
everyone
have
loves
adverts.
App.net.
Yeah, but if everybody I speak to is like, yeah, that was great. Well, can't be that good because it didn't last very long. And, you know, everybody, yeah. After the Elon thing, loads of people left, went to Mastodon, and then was like, well, this is a bit shit, and came back again.
Yeah. What the hell am I doing here? I don't know anyone here. No one agrees with me, and I can't become famous off of one tweet. What? Like, why? Why is this happening to me? I should be able to do the same thing here. No, but it's here we are to males talking about tech again. But God, it's I truly think a lot of people don't realize it, and it takes the people like. God, I listen to ATP and they don't want to talk about Elon, like you said, but it's a bigger issue. Like there's a bigger issue here. Unless it dies a hard death, there's never going to be an alternative.
Yeah. Unless someone physically pulls the plug, which is never going to happen really, is it? You know? There is nothing after Twitter. I mean, I love Twitter. As I've said numerous times, it's never going to get to, you know, there's periods in my life where I hate it, but it's never going to get to like net negative for me because I've achieved so much positive stuff on the service. You know, like we've met and interacted and we're now recording a podcast. You know, I've met people that I would just never meet and had conversations with and learned so much just purely through bullshit tweets, you know, on Twitter. It's just crazy to think that a simple service can do so much positive for me, but also so much negative for everybody else. I guess it's just one of those things that is just like the I don't even know how to pronounce it. It's just so much. It's like different things to different people, isn't it? And still, really, not that many people use it. You know, like to the as in like are active on it.
I actually, it's crazy to think about tech because my wife talked about how I have so many friends around the world, and you can find out so much about someone in like Google search if you know the general area that they live or where they went to school, et cetera, et cetera. So when people ask me, like, why do you trust people who are across the internet? It's because people use it. I'm going to turn into Apple here, but they use it as a town square. They know they let everyone know about them, and they make it known that this is what they do. This is who they are. This is their favorite thing. And it makes me feel comfortable when I can look up someone and I know that they're not, you know, creepy, I guess you would say. So it has its benefits, yeah. But like,
it's weird when you try to look somebody up and they have like either zero or very little presence. You're like, something's off.
I'll be honest. It makes a lot of people because I did the thing a long time ago where I'm still into it to this day, but like privacy and security and how they intermingle. And when I was younger, I gave away too much information, I think. And this was way before I understood how it worked. And I deleted a lot of old accounts. So Reddit accounts that were 9 years old and stuff like that are just gone. Well, they're set visibility to zero, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're not gone. And it makes it weird. So when people like reach out to me, they're like, oh, are you this person who posted on Reddit this long ago? Because I really liked what you posted. How are you doing? And while it's cool, it's also creepy.
Yeah, very. But I've had a couple of emails, you know, from really old blog posts, you know, like thanking me for stuff. But even then, I'm like, how did you find my email address? You know, like, it's not on the blog. You know, like, that must have took some digging. I mean, I'm really grateful for you to say thank you. You know, it'd be something random. I think the last one I got was like when I had a Lumia, like, Windows phone, you know, something went wrong, and I was like, oh, here's how you fix it. You know, you get an email, like, 6 years later, I'm like, what the hell? How did you find that? But there's a fundamental, like, trust in the internet, isn't there? And I think what you were saying about, you know, sharing too much when you're younger, I think that is also going to be a massive problem, you know, for the next generation coming through. Because not only have you got, like, you go, I would imagine most people get to 13, start sharing loads of information, you know, go, as I would say, balls deep into all the social media, but you've also got, you know, they've probably been on the internet their whole lives from their parents taking photos, and, you know, this is him at age 4, this is him at age 8. So all of a sudden you've got this whole timeline of people that might not necessarily want all that information on the internet at all.
Yeah, I'm going to give a shout out to Casey Liss for his app Masquerade, because that app makes me feel that if me and my wife decide that we want kids, I'm definitely going to do the whole, yes, I want to either talk about them or like share photos with family and stuff like that. But like, if I'm doing it in a more public area, I'm going to be covering their face, because I think that right to privacy should be their choice. And when they're that young, they don't actually know like what is right and what is wrong.
Yep.
It's hard too, because if you want to be prolific and you want to be like, I heard from you, I heard of you from a bunch of other people. Gabby from Twitter, actually.
Yep.
Was the one who introduced me to you.
Shout out to Gabs.
Oh, he does really cool pod. Yeah, Gabs. does really cool podcasts with a bunch of, like, a whole diverse amount of people. And that's how I found. So word of mouth is a big thing too. I don't really know where I was going with that, but like, there's so much to the internet, and I think that we don't always take it for granted, but I enjoy almost every part of it until it gets creepy or racist or homophobic or any of those.
I bet you must have strayed into some weird places of the internet, you know, like as quote unquote research or just personally.
Yeah. When I was younger, oh, this is a whole nother tangent, but when I was younger, understanding what the dark web was a big part of, because we were given laptops. My school district actually gave us Macs, so that's why. Jeez. I am not a Windows kid.
Expensive for school district. You went to some posh school.
Yeah, if someone wanted to do the research, they would be able to figure out where it was. But they gave all the teachers 13-inch MacBook Airs at the time. This was in 20... Oh, no. I graduated like 2012-ish. So, yeah. Like, the really bad screen ones.
Yeah, 11-inch, wasn't it? 11
before inch, Retina. Yeah. Before Retina.
Yeah.
So I got... The kids got the 11-inches. And unbeknownst to the school district, they didn't lock these things down at all. You could do whatever you wanted with them. Which in my case involved downloading Tor, and understanding how the dark net worked. The nice thing about them was that at that stage, Macs were still, no one was writing malware for them. No one cared about the platform because they didn't have as big of a market share as they do today.
Yeah, because it was such a tiny market share. I remember that being the argument to buy it way back in the day, wasn't it? It's like, oh, you don't get viruses.
Yeah, and now we're not even getting into that, because ATP just told people that they didn't need malware stuff, but I have seen some heavily infected malware Macs in my past, and it's not pretty. But even in 2012, the Darknet was a huge piece of figuring out that the above the iceberg internet is truly small. Got me into like a lot of raid forums where you go and you find people who are selling information, like personal information and stuff like that.
Right.
And from there on out, I'm just like, yep, this is a little bit much. This is a little bit ripe. I don't want to get myself into trouble. I guess I'll plead the fifth, but there's just so much out there.
Yeah.
The darknet is just a small subset of everything. Well, it's the biggest subset of the internet, but if you don't know what you're doing and you don't know what you're looking for, you turn up into some really sketchy areas. And I wonder if people realized what happened below that iceberg, then they would probably steer more clear of, you know, sharing information like this.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Using easy passwords, because this stuff is sold. Even if you're Joe Schmo from down the road, you could have $100,000 in your bank account, and you could be using password one as your password. And all of a sudden, your funds get drained because you used a terrible password, mm-hmm. and someone bought your information on the dark net.
Yeah.
So like, it's a slippery slope.
I guess that if people did realize that, all of a sudden this argument against, you know, like encryption on WhatsApp becomes a bit redundant, doesn't it?
Yeah. It comes back to the whole government's wanting to get rid of encryption. Like, how would you feel if you, as a House representative, I'm going to talk American politics because I know nothing about Europe.
I'm not entirely sure I know what politics goes on over here. You know, I just know they all look the same and they're all own ridiculous amounts of money that I do. And, you know, like, they try and be different, but they're just fundamentally all the same.
But how would they feel if they didn't have those protections in place and they weren't protected by their government and stuff like that? And they were just Joe Schmo from down the road and they got $100,000 taken away because encryption was outlawed or removed or et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
It's the whole reason why, again, getting back to hacking iPhones, why it's so prolific, because everything's an app now, and if you have control of someone's phone, you have control of it all.
Yeah, you're talking about, like, some of the NSO stuff is literally, like, zero mm-hmm. click, you know. I think it was on WhatsApp. They were able to send over the WhatsApp network information as if it was starting a video call that was silent, but then terminated itself, deleted it out of, you know, like, the recent call things. And obviously at that point then, you know, installed malware on the phone and they were able to start, you know, like, audio recordings, video recordings, and the works. You know, and we're talking about, you know, modern iPhones on the latest iOS software, but it was an app that installed on the phone was the reason why they were able to get into anything. It's crazy, you know. And
yeah, these zero click things. I didn't want to cut you off, but there are always going to be people who are smarter than the engineers making these either encryption algorithms or features, and I'm not saying it's not always going to work out in your favor, but there's always someone smarter than you, and that's a hard thing to say because a lot of people will be like, please don't say that,
because
it's kind of demeaning. But WhatsApp, used by millions of people, I don't even know the number.
Billions, probably.
Because I don't think companies share that anymore. Yeah, I don't think... Yeah. I think we'd be dumbfounded to know how many people truly use WhatsApp. But it's just everything's in our pockets now.
Yeah.
So it's super easy to target a device that you carry with you everywhere.
Mm.
And welcome to the positive podcast.
So I'm burning my iPhone tonight, you know, to get rid of it.
I think you made a good choice having an iPhone, though.
Yeah.
Because Apple is more working toward... I mean, Google is now, too. It's become such a problem that Google, the company who doesn't respect privacy very well, is moving towards adding things to the Android operating system that track when your microphone's on, or track if an app has permissions to the camera that it shouldn't, stuff like that. But
yeah,
it does make you want to burn your technology.
Yeah, it really does. But unfortunately, I can't live without my Twitter fix. It's like cocaine at this point. You know what I mean? So I have to carry on.
It's the It's the best cocaine. that adrenaline high is the best.
Yeah.
I don't think you can get it from anywhere else in the world.
There must have been some exciting times, you know, when you were delving deep into iPhones. You developed your own jailbreak at one point, right, Darwin?
Yeah, so you kind of touched on my name being a... So the default terminal password, well, the default root password for iPhones was Alpine. I come from the Northeast, and...
I'm glad you pointed that out, because I hadn't actually realized that was Alpine. Yeah, I'm dumb.
Yeah, so, well, I wouldn't say that, because all of us young hacker types like to put numbers and letters in the wrong spot so that no one understands. So, like, when people ask you what your Twitter handle is in person, which happened early on, you would say, A1, P1... 3, and they'd look at you, and you're like, can you say that slower? so 9.3.5 was a rough spot for jailbreaking itself. It went months and months and months and months without people trying to figure out how to jailbreak it. And this was so long ago that I don't remember the specifics, but I, with a friend of mine who was a web developer, I made a jailbreak package that had like a 15% positive rate of actually jailbreaking a device. I called it Darwin because, you know, I was all Mac, iPhone, so iPhones use the Darwin kernel. Version. But I really delved deep into hacking iOS and come to find out that the untether that I created, which was like, once you reboot the phone, you gotta click the jailbreak button again. Usually it was app based. It was like not nearly usable. The plan was to get it out and share it with the world, but at that point I truly don't think I knew enough to be able to make it better.
Right.
So this 10%, I actually had an iPhone 5S that was running it, which I actually still have. So maybe I'll pick that up and publish it one day, but it was using a really old kernel exploit, which relied on hardware. I'm trying to say this in like layman's terms, and it's so hard to when you get into this deep into it.
Yeah, I bet.
But iOS relies on a hardware device, kind of like you hear the T2 chips.
Okay, yeah.
In the Macs, it relies on a chip in the device to securely boot itself. So if it sees an operating system version that is not what it's supposed to be looking for, and it'll say no. Don't let that load, and you'll either get a black screen or you'll get a boot loop. I think you're familiar with boot loops since you jailbroke in the past, but there was a low level hardware problem in these old processors that Apple made that allowed you to bypass that check. Gosh, I haven't been in it long enough, forever, but it was able to bypass that check about 10% of the time.
Right, okay.
So you would have a fully functioning jailbreak every 10 times, and there's nothing saying that it was stable, but I did make one in the while back, a long time ago, actually.
Yeah.
That was my first and only one, and a couple people knew about it, and now whoever listens here knows about it. But I asked a few friends who made really big jailbreak tweaks if I could test it on their hardware, and they gave me the source code for their tweaks so that I could test it against it. And after about a couple months, I got bored, moved on to something else. So, yeah. while it's cool and while a lot of people can't say they did it, I don't think it's good enough to publish. And even if I did publish it, it basically doesn't work anymore because a lot of people have found a lot of better options.
There's a new, there's a new one. Polaris, is it?
Yep, Polaris, by, I don't actually remember who made it. Kind of like another hacker name. But it uses the, it leverages that hardware, exploit, reliably and is in untether so that you can reboot the phone as many times as you want. It still keeps your device jailbroken. I don't recommend that people jailbreak anymore. Now that I'm in the industry that I'm in.
Yes.
Because it does kind of open you up to Pegasus level things without the extra exploitation.
That was always the worry. When you were delving into like Cydia things and, you know, like installing third-party app stores and stuff, you didn't know what it was doing to your phone. You know, that was always what you were told. You know, like, it was always China. For some reason it was, these Chinese people have released this and it steals all your code or whatever it was. That was definitely always the worry because once your phone's jailbroken, essentially it's like party time, isn't it? All the shackles are off and an app can do what it likes.
We got really lucky with later jailbreaks that they were like semi untethers. So untether comes from you having to leave your phone plugged in to a Mac to actually do the jailbreak. And then once you unplugged your phone from the Mac, it would just turn back to normal. And that was the norm for a long time. But there was companies like Taiji and Pangu, who were Chinese firms who actually still jailbreak iOS today. They kind of show people that it's possible. Like, your security is not as good as you say it is, kind of thing. They don't release it anymore, but at one point you were going to random Chinese sites to download a jailbreak tool.
Yeah, Pangu. I remember Pangu.
Your phone. Yeah, they prolific with iOS 8. iOS 9 too, early iOS 9. But everyone was waiting for them to release something new. And no one really realized that. I mean, this was before iPhones were a huge haven for information, but no one realized what it meant to fully jailbreak your phone to its full potential. And while I'm happy that people like you and I were a part of that, nowadays that the information on those devices is too valuable, I'll say.
Again, you definitely
go back
put
to
in
the people who say they don't care.
Now would be put in, you know, like that back when I was doing this, you know, it was to increase the functionality of my phone, you know, and it was a trade-off, wasn't it? It was, you know, like, would I risk this, like risk versus reward? And I think that you got like the risk now, I think, is too far weighed out for me to do it. And I know that there's obviously a lot to still gain from jailbreaking it, but most of it comes down to, you know, theming, I guess, is probably the big thing which you were big into and probably still are.
Yeah, I moved from iPhone theming to graphic design at work, and I'll say Rising Linux, which is a whole different thing in its own. But yeah, I posted photos that now that we're in a podcast, people can't actually see unless you put it in the show notes. I would literally make my phone look like an Android phone, and a lot of people, when they picked up my phone, would be like, this is kind of ridiculous. How do you know what's what? But when you build something like that for yourself, it's not what it is. It's like what you decided it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I love that stuff. I have so many photos I had to choose. Like the top one is like an early iOS version. And the second one is when everyone got minimalistic and I had to be minimal. With my execution, but it truly brought the best people together. I'm super happy that I got into that world. I did DeviantArt. I did Reddit posts, like hundreds of upvotes kind of posts where people are just like, oh, I didn't think about this. Or, oh, this is a really good combination. Throwing colors in with... I have a bunch of setups that are like glaring white backgrounds, but the icons are like gorgeous, like renditions of like movies, films,
okay,
like animes and stuff like that. That was a big thing too. I don't know why those paths crossed ever, but I met some of the best people through that, and it was the funnest part of jailbreaking for me. Definitely making people look at your phone and go like, what WTF? Like, what is this, an iPhone or is it an iPhone looking yeah. Android?
Yeah.
And now we have the boring squircles on the phones, and it theming kind of came back with Widget Smith. I thank David Smith for hopefully getting Apple to allow you to change icon packs. One can hope that that's a possibility in the future, but I'm happy to see that people have adapted from that, and that fully personalizing your device isn't completely dead. But
yeah, some of it's interesting to hear you say, you know, like people look at your phone and go, like, how the hell do you use it? And I don't think, you know, theming and a lot of it in certainly in sort of jailbreak terms wasn't necessarily to make it look. It was just you wanted to make it look different. You know, you wanted to be yours. You wanted to, you know, I quite like the second picture that you posted, you know, the real minimalistic one with like a little image and stuff like that. And that's something that you would see on Android with like a big guide, and you're like, you know, to download this and download that and then download this and you hack it all together. It's just something that I would really like. You know, I'm not saying we need to go in this depth, but, you know, Apple to just embrace a bit more. You know, for people to able to just change the... I'd just like iOS to be a bit more fun. And the devices to be a bit more fun. You know, the colours suck a bit. And you know, I would just like to be able to if you wanted a minimalist setup, you know, just to be able to do it but with no questions asked.
Yeah, this is very exclusive to you, but I'll send you a few more after we're done. You can post them in the show notes. But these images have practically been removed from the internet, because I also did the thing where I like started deleting tweets, and I used to share all this kind of stuff on my Twitter, and okay, I still have a huge following of old theme people. But something about making your device more usable, this was in the days that I had a XS Max, I think,
okay,
or an iPhone 7 Pro, and these were big phones. Like, you were coming from like a 6 or you were coming from like a 5S. And these were big phones, and reachability was garbage, and there was no way to bring your icon... I mean, there still is no way to do this, but to bring your icons down so that you could reach them. So a lot of these setups were made so that I had reachability, and a lot of people don't think about that, but I'm envious of the Android people. I don't think I can move everything over.
No.
Now that I'm so deep into this ecosystem, I mean, we wouldn't be talking now. We'd be probably Skyping or whatever instead of FaceTime, but something about making your phone more usable than the OEM allows was the reason for a lot of this.
It's almost like
I don't need all this information on
it.
The lock screen.
You know, you just want to make it yours. Even if it's just a little bit different, I just want to do something different.
But, I mean, I love this kind of stuff. A couple of these things were things I made myself.
Mm.
I was doing HTML and CSS on a phone screen.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
I would go into Files or iFile at the time and modify these and then respring my device, which is like a soft reboot, just so that I could see the outcome.
Mm.
And I wasted so many battery cycles and so much time trying to like HTML and CSS on this little tiny phone screen. But like, I got results like you see and others will see in the show notes. But I still do wish I could do that today.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you think it's cool, because
yeah, I think so.
I cool. definitely spent hours and hours on this kind of stuff.
That was definitely the result you were looking for, wasn't it? You spent hours and hours and hours for some guy years later to go, yeah, it looks cool. Yeah, looks cool.
I mean, yeah, I think that's why you do it. It's flattery.
Yeah, in the internet in the future. Point.
Yeah. Whatever those are.
Whatever. What reason does anybody do anything apart from love from a significant other or internet points? That's just yep. the way of the world.
You're very right.
Yeah.
Does this gain me internet points? No. Okay, then I won't do it.
Yep. That's the whole reason Twitter exists.
No. For engagement.
It's definitely not to look cool on the internet. I do not look cool on Twitter.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you very much for joining me for a podcast. We babbled on for a little over an hour. I try and keep things succinct, but
goodness.
I'm terrified of using the internet now, and I'm going to go back to a flip phone.
I would not say you have to go that far, Greg, but if you ever want to talk again, if things happen,
you'll be my on-call security expert.
Sure. We'll go with that. Yeah. I guess I'll open up my books for you, and the rest of my family can just wait.
I like that idea. I like it.
No IT for you.
Yeah.
No IT.
Greg got hacked.
But it was nice talking to you.
Awesome. It's been a blast. I'm never quite sure about meeting new people and how things will go, but you were one of those guys that just gelled straight away and just managed to talk about interesting concepts and at the same time blow my mind.
I'd love to do it again anytime you want.
Awesome. Right. The last thing that I always ask is if you really want people to follow you, if you're not going to delete everything off the internet, where's the best the best place for people to head? Obviously to Twitter.
Twitter. I'm pretty sure that's all I do. I actually, Gabs, another shout out to him, started getting me to do microblogs.
Okay.
So I'll send that to you to put in the.
You're on micro. I'm also on microblog at the moment.
I am on microblog.
I have this love hate relationship with microblog, but I am on it currently.
I think I love it because it's short form, and at the same time, if I really wanted to like write a technical article, I could. But
yeah.
I'll give that to you for the show notes, and because I'm pretty sure it's just Alpine without all the numbers, but
okay.
Who knows how those short codes work.
There's lots of Alpine, so I'll let you send me the link yep. to see which one it is.
I'll send you it.
Awesome. Thanks again, Zach, for talking to me. It's been great.
Thank you.
And I will speak to you very soon, I hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Catch you later, dude. That wraps up another episode, and I'm at the end of my guest list, so I hope you enjoyed that one, because you may never hear from me again. If you want to follow Zachary on Twitter, he's at Alpine, as we spoke about in the show. It's A1P1N3. Until the next time, my friends, take the very best care of yourself. Hopefully, I'll speak to you all soon.